Scholastic Audiobooks presents The Looking Glass Wars by Frank Bedore, read by Gerard Doyle.
Prologue. Oxford, England, July 1863. Everyone thought she had made it up. And she had tolerated more taunting and teasing from other children, more lectures and punishments from grown-ups than any 11-year-old should have to bear. But now, after 4 years, it had arrived. Her last, best chance to prove to them all that she had been telling the truth. A college scholar had thought enough of her history to write it up as a book. She sat on a blanket on the banks of the River Sherwell, the remains of a picnic lunch in a basket at the Reverend Charles Dodgson's elbow. She held the book in her hands. He had written and illustrated it himself, he said. It had a nice weight and heft, felt substantial. It was wrapped in brown paper and tied with a black ribbon. Dodgson was watching her, anxious. Her sisters Edith and Lorena were hunting minnows at the river's edge. She untied the ribbon, carefully undid the wrapping.
Oh, Alice's Adventures Underground? What sort of title was that? And why was her name misspelled?
She had told Dodgson how to correctly spell her name, had even written it out for him.
By Lewis Carroll? She read with growing concern. I thought it would be more festive than saying it was by a reverend.
Festive? She had told him little that was festive. Concern was fast turning to alarm, but she swallowed it. What mattered was that he had faithfully recorded her history in Wonderland as she remembered it. She opened the book and admired its rough-cut pages, the neatness of the handwriting. But the dedication took the form of a poem, in which her name was again misspelled, and she didn't think the light-hearted rhyme scheme appropriate, considering the material it was supposed to introduce. Her gaze caught on one of the stanzas. The dream child moving through a land of wonders, wild and new, in friendly chat with bird or beast, and half believed it true.
Dream child? And what did he mean by half-believed?
She turned to the first chapter and immediately felt as if her insides had been scooped out like the half-grapefruits Dean Liddell ate for breakfast every morning, after which only raw, pulpy hollows remained.
Down a rabbit hole? Where had the worrisome white rabbit come from? Alice, is something wrong?
She skipped ahead, turned page after page.
The pool of tears, the caterpillar, her Aunt Red. It had all been twisted into nonsense.
I admit that I took a few liberties with your story, Dodgson explained, to make it ours, as I said I would.
Do you recognise the tutor fellow you once described to me?
He's the White Rabbit character. I got the idea for him upon discovering that the letters of the tutor's name could be made to spell White Rabbit.
Here, let me show you.
Dodgson took a pencil and small notebook from the inside pocket of his coat, but she didn't want to look. He had indeed said it would be their book, his and hers, and she had found strength in that. Strength to suffer the indignities that came from insisting on truths no one else believed. But what she held in her hands had nothing to do with her.
You mean you did it on purpose? She asked.
The grinning Cheshire cat, the mad tea party. He transformed her memories of a world alive with hope and possibility and danger into make-believe, the foolish stuff of children. He was just another in a long line of unbelievers, and this stupid, nonsensical book was how he made fun of her. She had never felt more betrayed in all her life.
No one is ever going to believe me now, she screamed. You've ruined everything.
"You're the cruelest man I've ever met, Mr. Dodgson. And if you had believed a single word I told you, you'd know how very cruel that is. I never want to see you again. Never, never, never."
She ran, leaving Edith and Lorena to make their own way home, leaving the Reverend Dodgson, who considered children to be spirits fresh from God's hands, their smiles divine, who thought there could be no greater endeavour than devoting all of his powers to a task for which the only reward was a child's whispered thanks and the airy touch of her pure lips, shaken, unsure of what had just happened. He picked up the book, still warm from Alice Liddell's touch, not knowing that it was as close to her as he'd ever be again. Part 1 Chapter 1 The Queendom had been enjoying a tentative peace ever since the time 12 years earlier when unbridled bloodshed spattered the doorstep of every Wonderlander. The Civil War hadn't been the longest in all of recorded history, but no doubt it was one of the bloodiest. Those who had entered a little too quickly into the carnage and destruction had trouble adapting to life during peacetime. When hostilities ceased, they ran amok on the streets of Wonderland's capital city, looting and pillaging Wondertropolis until Queen Genevieve had them rounded up and shipped off to the Crystal Mines, a spiderweb-like network of tunnels carved in a far-off mountainside, where those unwilling to abide by the laws of decent society lived in windowless dormitories and laboured to excavate crystal from the unforgiving mountain. Even after these people were taken off the streets, the peace that settled on Wonderland was nothing like that which had existed before the war. A third of Wondertropolis's quartz-like buildings had to be rebuilt. The smooth, turquoise amphitheatre had suffered damage in an air raid, as had the public works towers and spires sporting fiery, reflective pyrite skin. But the scars of war are not always visible. Although Queen Genevieve ruled her queendom judiciously, with care for the well-being of her people, the monarchy had been forever weakened. The coalition of diamond, club and spade dynasties that made up Parliament was falling apart. The matriarchs of the families were jealous of Genevieve's power. Each thought she could rule Wonderland better than the Queen. Each watched and waited for an opportunity to wrest control from her, keeping a none-too-friendly eye on the other families in case they happened to make a move first. After 12 years, the daily life of Wonderland had returned to what might be called normal. Were you to walk Wondertropolis's gleaming streets, enjoying the sight of its jagged crystal buildings and shopfronts? Were you to pass the stations where Wonderlanders arrived for work in sleek glass tubes hovering on cushions of air? Were you to stop and purchase a tarty-tart from a vendor and relish its tarty-tart flavour bursting upon your tongue? You would never have known that in certain back alleys, on certain open plains, precautions were being taken. Regiments of card soldiers put through military manoeuvres, transports produced, weapons of attack and defence designed and tested. And you would not have been alone. Entertaining no thoughts of war, Princess Alice Hart stood on the balcony of Hart Palace with her mother, Queen Genevieve. The city was in the midst of a jubilant gala. From the everlasting forest to the Valley of Mushrooms, Wonderlanders had come to celebrate the 7th birthday of their future queen, who, as it happened, was bored out of her wits. Alice knew she could do a lot worse than be Queen of Wonderland. But even a future monarch doesn't always want to do what she is supposed to do, like sit through hours of pageantry. She would rather have hidden with her friend Dodge in one of the palace towers, dropping jolly jellies from an open window and watching them splat on the guards below. Dodge wouldn't like the jolly jelly bit. Guardsmen deserve better treatment, he'd say. But that would only make it more fun. Where was Dodge, anyway? She hadn't seen him all morning, and it wasn't nice to avoid the birthday girl on her birthday. She searched for him among the Wonderlanders gathered to watch the inventor's parade on the cobbled lane below. No sign of him, He was probably off doing something fun. Whatever it was had to be more fun than being stuck here, forced to watch Wonderlanders show off their silly contraptions. Bibwit Hare, the royal tutor, had explained to her that most of Wonderland took pride in the Inventor's Parade, the one time every year when citizens flaunted their skills and ingenuity before the Queen. If Genevieve saw something in the parade that she thought particularly good, she would send it into the Heart Crystal, a 33-foot-tall, 52-foot-wide, shimmering crystal on the palace grounds, the power source for all creation. Whatever passed into the crystal went out into the universe to inspire imaginations in other worlds. If a Wonderlander bounced in front of Queen Genevieve on a spring-operated stick with handlebars and footrests, and she passed this curious invention into the crystal, before long, in one civilization or another, a pogo stick would be invented. Still, Alice wondered, what was the big deal? Having to stand here until her feet hurt, it was punishment. I wish Father were here. He's due back from Borderland at any moment, said Queen Genevieve. But since the rest of Wonderland is here, I suggest you try to enjoy yourself for their sake. That's interesting, don't you think? They watched as a man floated down from the sky with what looked like a hollow mushroom cap strapped to his back. It's pretty good, I suppose, said Alice. But it'd be better if it were furry. And with that, the mushroom contraption was suddenly covered in fur, its inventor falling to the ground with a thump. Queen Genevieve frowned. He's late, Alice said. He promised he'd be here. I don't understand why he had to make a trip so close to my birthday. There were reasons, as the Queen well knew. Intelligence had indicated that they may have already waited too long. Unconfirmed reports suggested Red was growing more powerful, outfitting her troops for an attack, and Genevieve was no longer sure that her military could provide adequate defence. She was as keen as Alice for King Nolan's return, but she had determined to enjoy the day's festivities. "Oh, look at that!" she said, pointing at a woman wiggling as she walked, so as to keep a large hoop swinging round and round her waist. "That looks diverting!" It'd be more fun if it had fountains of water coming out of it, Alice said. And immediately the hoop was spurting water from tiny holes all along its surface, the surprised inventor still wiggling to keep it swinging round and round. Birthday or not, Alice, Queen Genevieve said, I don't think it's nice to show off. The fur on the first ever parachute vanished. The fountains of water on the newly invented hula hoop dried up. The power of Alice's imagination had made them appear and disappear. Imagination was an important part of life in Wonderland, and Alice had the most powerful imagination ever seen in a 7-year-old Wonderlander. But, as with any formidable talent, Alice's imagination could be used for good or ill, and the Queen saw mild reasons for concern. Hardly one revolution of the Thermite Moon had passed since Alice's last incident. Impatient with young Jack of Diamonds for some childish indiscretion, she'd imagined his trousers filled with slick, squiggling squirmies. Jack of Diamonds had said he felt something funny, looked down, and saw that his trousers were moving, alive. He'd been having nightmares ever since. Alice claimed not to have done it on purpose, which may or may not have been true. Genevieve couldn't tell. Alice didn't yet have full control of her imaginative powers, but the girl would say anything to get out of trouble. You will be the strongest queen yet, she told her daughter. Your imagination will be the crowning achievement of the land. But Alice, you must work hard to develop it according to the guiding principles of the Heart Dynasty. Love, justice, and duty to the people. An undisciplined imagination is worse than no imagination at all. It can do more harm. Remember what happened to your Aunt Red? I know, Alice said sulkily. She had never met her Aunt Red, but she'd heard stories about the woman for as long as she could remember. She didn't bother trying to understand it all. It was history. Boring, boring, boring. But she knew that to be like Aunt Red wasn't good. "Now that's enough lecturing for one princess's birthday," Queen Genevieve said. She clapped her hands and the parachute and hula hoop passed into the heart crystal, much to the joy of their inventors. An empty pair of King Nolan's boots floated out from behind the balcony door and began to dance in front of the brooding princess. Queen Genevieve, watching yet another extraordinary display of her daughter's imagination, said, "Alice?" Something in her tone made the girl stop what she was doing. The boots thudded to the ground, still. "It's all in your head," the Queen sighed. "Remember that, love. Whatever happens, it's all in your head." It was both a warning and an expression of hope. Queen Genevieve, aware of the dark forces at work somewhere in the wastes of the chessboard desert, knew that joy and happiness didn't last forever in Wonderland. Sooner or later, the Queendom would come under attack, and it would require all of Alice's imaginative powers, and then some, to ensure its survival. Chapter 2 2 days into their return trek through Outer Wilder Bestia, King Nolan and his men urged their spirit danes at a gallop along a narrow mountain ridge. Four-legged creatures, with bodies that looked vaguely bulldoggish from the front and tapered to a thin, tailless rear end. Spirit danes had flat faces with slow, blinking eyes, fist-sized nostrils, and a quizzical mouth. They were not the fastest means of getting around Wonderland, but they proved the most efficient mode of travel to and from Borderland, being the only creatures capable of carrying a man, as well as gifts of wine and crystal, while making decent time over the irregular terrain of Outer Wilder Bestia. This had not been a journey King Nolan desired to make. He had done it for the good of the Queendom. A last-minute negotiation with King Arch of Borderland to establish an alliance between their two nations against Red. It was, of course, Genevieve's rightful place to conduct all negotiations, but she had thought it prudent to send her husband in her stead. Borderland was a kingdom. King Arch didn't believe in queendoms. The seat of power, he often proclaimed, was no place for a female. King Arch greeted Nolan as if the mere sight of him brought on fatigue. "Why should I form an alliance?" he asked, after Nolan had just explained the reasons. "Red doesn't dare attack Borderland." "Because we're neighbours, Arch. If Red does take control of Wonderland, she's likely to grow more ambitious and look to Borderland as her next target." "Oh, I think I can defend myself against any female, even without an alliance." Arch snapped his fingers, and a shapely courtesan emerged from behind a glittering curtain to massage his shoulders. "Besides, it rather goes against my principles, partnering with a queendom. I don't want the peculiar ways of your nation influencing Borderland's female population. The last thing I need is the seeds of some so-called greater purpose being planted in their feminine heads, as if they should do more with their lives than is required for their marital administrations." "I'd be more concerned about the influence a red-controlled Wonderland would have on your entire population," said King Nolan. King Arch made a sound deep within his throat, a doubtful grunt. "Frankly, Nolan, I don't have the highest regard for you, letting yourself be bossed around by your wife as you do." King Nolan did not feel, nor had he ever felt, bossed around by Genevieve. He loved his wife in part because of her strength, her inestimable handling of the very responsibilities that Arch thought should fall only on a man's shoulders. To Nolan, nothing could compare to the love of his kind, strong-willed queen.
"So,"
Arch said, You'd receive military support to help defend against your enemies. And what would I get? What benefits would the people of Borderland be able to expect as a result of this proposed nation coupling? I am prepared to offer you crystal mining rights within our borders, twice yearly payments of 1,000,000 howlite gemstones, and the use of our military, should the need for it ever arise. King Arch stood. The meeting was over. I'll consider it and send word of my decision in the next week or so. Eager to arrive back at Hart Palace in time for Alice's birthday, Nolan made a race of the journey with his men, riding at full speed without stopping for rest or food. They were still half a day's ride away. The mountain ridge was far behind them now, and they galloped across a dusty plain. At the crest of a hill, with Hart Palace visible on the horizon, Nolan reined in his spirit dane. A gust of wind carried with it, or so he imagined, for he was quite a distance from the palace, the sounds of revelry, music and laughter. His men came to a stop beside him. "What is it, my lord?" "She'll never forgive me for missing the party." "I think the Queen would forgive you anything, my lord." "Not the Queen, the Princess. Oh, with her you'll have trouble." The men laughed. With Alice, King Nolan would indeed have trouble. But it would be a pleasant sort of trouble. Even in her pouts, he thought his daughter a delightful creature.
"Hi-ya!"
With a refreshed sense of urgency, the king prodded his spirit dane onward, toward home and family. Chapter 3 Bibwit Hare gathered together books and papers in preparation for his charge's lessons the next day. Now that she had reached her 7th birthday, Alice would begin her formal training to become queen.
"And being a queen isn't easy," muttered Bibwit Hare. "The position comes with tremendous responsibilities. One has to study law and government and ethics and morality. One must train the imagination for the promotion of peace and harmony and the precepts of white imagination, because black imagination is not what anybody wants at all, oh no. And if that isn't enough, there's the looking-glass maze to get through."
Bibwit Hare, alone in the library at Hart Palace, recited from an ancient Wonderland text in Queendom Speramus.
"A unique looking-glass maze exists for every would-be queen. The maze must be successfully navigated by the would-be queen if she is to reach her imagination's full potential and thus be fit to rule."
The tutor returned to his usual tone.
"But where the looking-glass maze is, only the caterpillars know."
Mr. Bibwit Hare was an albino, 7 feet tall, with bluish-green veins pulsing visibly beneath his skin, and ears a bit large for his head, ears so sensitive that he could hear someone whispering from 3 streets away. He was rather intelligent, but he had the habit of talking to himself, which more than a few Wonderlanders found strange, particularly members of the Diamond, Spade and Club families, not one of whom had ever forgiven him for his decades-long schooling of the Hart daughters as opposed to their own. Not that Bibwit paid much attention to what others thought of him. He talked to himself because there weren't many people as learned as he, and he liked to talk to learned people.
"Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you."
Bibwit threw open a pair of doors leading to the royal gardens, and the chorus of voices might have become painfully loud to his finicky ears if it had been any other song sung to any other princess. But he found nothing too much when it was in appreciation of Alice. Among the assembled guests being led in song by the garden's sunflowers, tulips and daisies, Bibwit spied various members of the suit families. He bowed to the Lady of Diamonds when he caught her eye, and General Doppelganger, commander of the royal army, who suddenly split in two and became the twin figures of Generals Doppel and Ganger, so as to lend two voices to the song instead of one. Bibwit bowed to the blue caterpillar, that oracle of oracles, sage of sages, wisest of the wise, sitting curled in a corner of the garden, puffing on his hookah, while a gwynook, a small creature with a penguin's body and an old man's wrinkled face, waddled about on his back.
"Waddling is an underappreciated art," Bibwit heard the gwynook say to the caterpillar. "Say, let me have a puff of that."
grumbled the caterpillar, who never shared his pipe with gwynooks, even on the happy occasion of Alice Hart's birthday.
"Smoking's bad for you. It is indeed a special day when a caterpillar comes all the way from the Valley of Mushrooms to partake in the celebration,"
Bibwit Hare murmured, watching two spirit Danes pull a giant cake toward Alice, a host of tuttle birds glowing and flapping their wings in place of candles. Next to the birthday girl stood the Queen, and behind her, Hatter Madigan, leading member of Wonderland's elite security force known as the Millinery, and the Queen's personal bodyguard. Carrying the backpack, common among millinery men, wearing a long coat and bracelets, and the top hat he took off only in times of violence, he alone in the crowd remained stoic, alert. The song ended. The guests applauded, and Queen Genevieve said, "Make a wish, Alice."
"Besides wishing that Father had never gone on his trip," Alice declared, "I wish to be queen for a day."
Her mother's crown lifted into the air and floated toward her head. The guests laughed, all except Hatter Madigan, who never laughed.
"Hatter Madigan," sighed Bibwit, "even you should relax sometimes and enjoy yourself."
"You'll be queen soon enough,"
Genevieve said to her daughter. The Queen's imagination was not exactly weak, and the crown floated back onto her head. Alice noticed Bibwit standing at the library doors and decided to have a little fun. It was the least she could do until she found Dodge. She whispered,
"Do you want some cake, Bibwit Hare?"
The tutor nodded, and she brought him a slice of cake on an edible chocolate plate.
"Happy unbirthday to you," she said.
"It's raisin butterscotch with peanut butter, marshmallows and gummy wads. It's the best."
Bibwit stared at the cake.
"Yes, well, thank you, Alice. But I'm afraid you won't be so nice to me after we begin our lessons tomorrow."
"I won't need any lessons," Alice said. "I'll just imagine that I know everything and then I will, so you won't have to give them to me."
Bibwit picked at the cake, examining it, squinting at it.
"My dear," he said, "you can't imagine everything because you don't know everything there is to imagine. That's precisely where the lessons come in. Trust me, I know what I'm talking about. I taught your grandmother and your mother when they were your age, and yes, I did try to teach the woman who shall not be named, namely your Aunt Red, but we won't go into that."
Not at all sure that it was the right thing to do, Bibwit put a bit of cake into his mouth. He chewed once, twice, but something was amiss. The stuff in his mouth felt like it was moving. Alice started to laugh. Bibwit spat the half-chewed cake into the palm of his hand and saw that it wasn't cake at all. It had turned into a handful of gwormies.
"Got you!"
Alice shouted and ran away. The gwormy prank hadn't been nice, not nice in the least, but Bibwit was willing to forgive. Alice was young. She needed to be taught. She might remind him of Red in certain things, but he was confident that she wouldn't grow up to be like her. He wouldn't let it happen. Besides, he couldn't blame Alice for needing to occupy herself somehow. There were hardly any children her age at the palace. He cast a last gaze about the gardens. The blue caterpillar had slithered off somewhere. Frog, the palace's internal messenger, was hopping about in his finest clothes, no doubt longing for some guest to entrust him with a message for another guest. Generals Doppel and Ganger were again in one body, and they, or rather he, General Doppelganger, was conversing with Sir Justice Anders, head of the palace guardsmen. Hatter Madigan, following the Queen like a protective shadow, remained as unexpressive as ever. Bibwit retired to the library, where picture books from Alice's earliest youth sat on shelves next to a 10-volume chronicle of the Civil War, written from various points of view. The card soldiers who'd fought on the front lines, members of the chessmen militia, General Doppelganger and his sergeants, even Queen Genevieve herself. It came complete with lists of those killed in each of the battles and explanations of the strategies that had called for the sacrifice of Wonderlander lives. Bibwit took down the first volume of the Chronicle and set it with the other books and papers he'd collected for Alice's lessons. The book contained a catalogue of atrocities committed by Red, torture, the slaughtering of prisoners, mass graves. The tutor had always viewed Red's fall into the diabolical as his fault, a failure in her education.
"It's never too soon for a future queen to become familiar with the uglier contingencies of ruling a land," he said to himself.
Chapter 4 King Nolan and his men left Outer Wildebeestia behind. They passed through a narrow stretch of the everlasting forest and were stampeding through the eastern edge of Wondertropolis, the most rural area of the capital, home to farmers and those favouring the quiet country life, when their spirit danes stopped and reared up on their hind legs, agitated. Speckled across the tranquil landscape, looking harmless and partly camouflaged by the day's lengthening shadows, were Red's undealt card soldiers, lying flat one on top of another, each deck 52 soldiers thick, awaiting orders.
"Red's decks are stacked!"
So whatever King Arch decided, it would no longer matter. Wonderland didn't have the luxury of waiting for his answer.
"We have to warn the palace," said King Nolan.
One of his men removed a looking-glass communicator from his saddlebag and began tapping out a coded message on its keyboard. If the soldier had had time to hit the send button, his message would have appeared on a crystal viewer in the security oversight room of Hart Palace. But with a sound akin to the metal blades of scissors rapidly opening and closing, an unseen deck hidden in nearby underbrush fanned out and surrounded the king and his men. The air filled with adrenaline-induced war cries from Red soldiers, agony-infused moans from the throats of King Nolan's men. The looking-glass communicator fell against a rock and shattered, its owner dead before the device hit the ground. The Wonderlanders were outnumbered 5-1. At the centre of the skirmish, slashing his sword this way and that, was King Nolan, still atop his trusted spirit dane, when a figure in a scarlet cloak passed through the fighting untouched and stabbed him through the heart with her pointed sceptre.
"My queen!"
he moaned, slumping into death, blood leaking from the corners of his mouth.
"My queen!"
Chapter 5
"Got him! I got him! I got him!"
A laughing Alice left Bibwit Hare frowning at the half-eaten Gwurmies in his hand and ran into the palace's ISA room, where, finally, she found Dodge Anders standing to attention, waiting for her. He looked as if he would have waited for her all his life, if necessary.
"I was wondering where you were," she said, breathless. "I thought you were ignoring me."
"I had to get you a present, didn't I? Why are you running?"
"No reason."
"Uh-huh." Dodge knew she must have been up to something. She was always up to something. But he let it go. He handed her a small box tied with red ribbon and bowed. "Happy birthday, princess."
"Cut it out!"
Alice didn't like her best friend bowing to her, and he knew it. Hadn't she told him so countless times? Saying she didn't care if he was a commoner, she just didn't want him doing it. He was her elder by 3 years and 4 months. Did he like bowing to a younger girl? And what was so bad or lowly about being a commoner anyway? It gave Dodge the freedom to venture out beyond the palace grounds, and Alice wouldn't have minded that. For all her rebellion and free spirit, she had never been outside the luxurious confines of Hart Palace. She opened the present and stared down at a gleaming, sharp, triangular-shaped tooth resting on a bed of puff.
"Jabberwock tooth," Dodge said.
"You didn't kill the beast yourself, I hope?"
Jabberwocky were huge, ferocious creatures living in the volcanic plains, a land of active volcanoes, lava rivers, and geysers of noxious gas, extremely dangerous for any Wonderlander to enter. But you never could tell what Dodge might do. Ever since the age of 3, when he toddled into the coat of his father's guardsman uniform and saluted, the direction of his life had been known. Dodge wanted nothing more than to be like his father, Sir Justice Anders, who had distinguished himself with his bravery in the Civil War and been awarded his current position by the Queen herself. Dodge now stood before Alice in his own guardsman uniform, complete with fleur-de-lis badge.
"No, I didn't kill the Jabberwock," he said. "I bought that in a shop." "I'll keep it forever," Alice said.
She slipped the tooth onto her necklace. She had grown up with Dodge. Couldn't remember a time in her life when he hadn't been her partner in adventure. By her bed she kept a holographic crystal that showed him at 4 years old, kissing her cheek as she sat in her royal baby carriage. Officers of the court stood frowning in the background. What their problem was, Alice never understood, but she cherished the crystal all the same. Dodge became embarrassed whenever she showed it to him, so she showed it to him often. He knew why the court officers were frowning. The importance of class distinctions, of consorting with your own kind. Alice might not care about such stuff, but Sir Justice had explained the situation to his son, and Dodge understood that part of being a successful guardsman meant abiding by what was considered proper, by not allowing his affections for anybody, especially Alice, to compromise his duty. "You can never marry the princess, Dodge," Sir Justice had explained, sympathetic, even a little proud that the princess had taken a liking to his son. "She will one day be your queen. You can show your affection by serving her to the best of your ability, but she has to marry someone from a suit family. And Jack of Diamonds is the only boy of proper rank, close to her age. I'm sorry, Dodge, but you and the princess, it's not in the cards."
"I understand, Father."
But this had been only half true. Dodge's head understood. His heart did not.
"Don't you have to practice any military exercises?" Alice asked now.
"I can always use more practice, my princess."
"Stop calling me that. You know I don't like it."
"I can never forget who and what you are, my princess." Alice clicked her tongue. Sometimes Dodge's seriousness could be tiresome.
"I have a new military exercise for you," she said. "We must pretend we're enjoying ourselves at a party. Music is playing, there are mounds of delicious food, and you and I begin to dance."
She held out her hand. Dodge hesitated.
"Come on now."
He put an arm around Alice's waist and moved with her in gentle circles. He had never touched the princess before, not like this. She smelled of sweet earth and powder. It was a clean, delicate smell. Did all girls smell like this, or only princesses? A potted sunflower in the corner of the room began to serenade them. "This isn't a military exercise," he said, making a weak attempt to free himself.
"I order you not to go anywhere. While we're dancing, Red and her soldiers crash into the room. It's a surprise attack. People are screaming and running. People are dying. But you stay calm. You promise to protect me."
"You know I'd protect you, Alice." He felt warm all over and a little dizzy. He was holding the princess close. He could feel her breath on his cheek. he was the luckiest boy in the Queendom.
And then you battle Red and her soldiers.
He didn't want to let her go, but he did, brandishing his sword. He jousted this way and that with his imaginary foes, spinning and ducking in imitation of Hatter Madigan, whose military workouts he often watched and studied.
And after many close calls, Alice narrated, your life in danger every second, you defeat the soldiers and stab your sword into Red.
Dodge looked the picture of intensity as he plunged his sword into the air where he envisioned Red to be. He made a show of eyeing his handiwork, his vanquished foes littered on the ground before him. He returned his sword to its scabbard.
I'm saved, Alice continued, but I'm shaken by what I've just witnessed. You calm my nerves by dancing with me.
The sunflower in the corner again began to serenade. Without hesitation this time, Dodge took Alice and spun her about the room. He had loosened up despite himself, despite what he knew his father would think of his behaviour. He was revelling in feelings he should not have allowed himself to feel.
Will you be my king, Dodge?
If it pleases you, princess, he said, trying to be nonchalant.
You there, clean my boots, a voice shouted from the corridor. Servant, do my bidding.
Dodge immediately stepped away from Alice, stood stiffly to attention.
Wash my waistcoat, make my bed, powder my wig,
the voice shouted. 10-year-old Jack of Diamonds, heir to the Diamond family estate, marched into the ISA room. He stopped when he saw Alice and Dodge.
What are you doing?
Alice asked him.
I'm practicing being a royal personage. What does it look like I'm doing?
Jack of Diamonds would have been a handsome boy, if not for his bullying personality, and for the fact that he had the biggest, roundest rear end in Wonderland. It looked like he carried an inflated cushion in the back of his trousers. He also had the silly pretension of wearing a long, white, powdered wig, because he'd heard that the well-to-do in other worlds wore powdered wigs. He eyed the discarded box and ribbon on the floor. He eyed the jabberwock tooth hanging from Alice's necklace.
The question is, he said, what are you two doing?
Neither Alice nor Dodge answered.
Playing mushy, mushy love with the princess, are we?
He laughed and approached Alice, touched the jabberwock tooth hanging at her throat.
Leave that alone, Dodge warned. Sweet princess, when we're older and you're my wife, I'll give you presents of diamonds and more diamonds, not the rotten teeth of stupid animals.
Just go away,
Alice pleaded.
Leave her alone, said Dodge. I mean it.
Jack of Diamonds turned to face this son of a guardsman. He put a finger to his lips and pretended to be deep in thought.
Let me see now. Ah, I've got it. Eeny, meeny, miny, moo, I'm more important than you.
Dodge flung out his fists and knocked Jack to the floor, left him splayed there with his wig askew, looking not at all like a person of high rank. Dodge braced himself for a fight, but Jack scrambled to his feet and ran out of the room and down the corridor toward the royal gardens.
We have to get out of here if we don't want to be in trouble, Alice said. He'll tell his father on you.
It wasn't at all the sort of thing a guardsman should do, but Dodge grabbed Alice's hand and led her to a life-size sculpture of Queen Isa, Alice's great-grandmother. He pressed on the ruby at the front of Isa's crown, and a door in the wall appeared, opening onto one of the many servants' tunnels that ran under Hart Palace.
Where are we going?
Alice asked.
You'll see.
Hand in hand, they raced off down the tunnel, past guardsmen headed to their watchposts, past servants carrying platters of jolly jellies, fried wonder crumpets, and tarty tarts.
Chapter 6. If you're a queen, even the most light-hearted conversation on a festive day can lead to a discussion of troublesome topics. In the royal gardens, Genevieve found herself talking to the Lady of Clubs and the Lady of Spades
about the unwelcome influence of black imagination societies on Wonderland's youth.
"I hear they drink Jabberwocky blood," said the Lady of Spades.
"Well, I think it's disgusting that children today take for granted the peace and harmony that currently exist in the Queendom," declared the Lady of Clubs. "It's as if they want to destroy the current state of things just for the sake of destroying it."
"We have members of the millinery working undercover, infiltrating many of the groups," Queen Genevieve informed them.
"Really?"
The Lady of Clubs encouraged any endeavour that might weaken Genevieve's grip on the throne. She smiled at the Queen and decided, not without reluctance, to end her sponsorship of black imagination societies. It was as she came to this determination that Jack of Diamonds, running along a heart-shaped passage toward the gardens, suddenly found himself lifted off his feet, his wig again knocked askew. He wriggled to get free, his feet pedalling the air.
"What's the rush, little fellow?" asked Bibwit Hare. "What seems to be the trouble?"
"You're the little fellow," Jack said.
Well, in the grand scheme of the cosmos, I am a little fellow. We're all quite little, if you think about it that way."
"Good point, Jack."
Jack didn't know what the pale scholar was talking about and didn't care.
"Unhand me, you tutor!"
With his feet once again on solid ground, trying to right his wig but succeeding only in turning it almost completely backward, Jack of Diamonds explained how he had been minding his own business when all of a sudden Dodge jumped out from behind a bookcase, knocked him to the ground and dirtied his pantaloons. Jack had only meant to rescue the princess, whom Dodge, the commoner, had been trying to kiss, and now he was on his way to tell his father and Queen Genevieve so that they'd deport Dodge to the crystal mines, which surely wasn't too great a punishment for such serious crimes.
"Those are serious crimes," agreed Bibwit Hare. "But, Jack, don't you think it's time you started handling the responsibilities of your rank?"
The boy grew suspicious.
"Maybe.
At your age, you shouldn't need your father's help administering punishments. I will hunt out the culprit and bring him to you. Go and enjoy a nice bit of tarty-tart and say nothing of this terrible incident to anyone until I return. You will surprise the Queen with your judicious punishment of Dodge, I'm sure."
Bibwit watched the boy strut up the passageway, his round rear jiggling left, right, all the way to the royal gardens. With his ultra-sensitive ears, Bibwit Hare had heard everything that had happened in the ISA room. Only when he was positive that Jack would say nothing of the trifling matter to the Queen or the Lord of Diamonds, only when he heard the boy greedily munching on a tarty-tart, did he set out after Alice and Dodge. Cocking his head, as might a dog hearing a strange high-pitched noise, he listened to far-off sounds. He heard a husband and wife discussing their upcoming safari in Outer Wildebeestia. He heard a shopkeeper totalling up his accounts three streets away. And then he heard a mishmash of humble voices. Using his hearing as a guide, he made his way out of the palace. Alice and Dodge ran through the servants' tunnels, Alice yelping with laughter and quite enjoying herself. Dodge, all business, until he shouldered open a door and they stepped out into the light of Wondertropolis. For the first time in her life, Alice Hart was outside the grounds of the palace.
Whoa!
It was a festive scene. Wonderlanders dancing, playing musical instruments and acting out mini theatricals. A shopkeeper spotted Alice and, with respectful expressions of good wishes for her health, dropped to his knees. Seeing who was among them, Wonderlander after Wonderlander followed his example, and in less than half a minute, Alice and Dodge were standing at the centre of a bowing, reverent audience.
"'Yeah,' Dodge said in a loud voice to no one in particular. "'She looks a lot like Princess Alice, doesn't she? But her name's Stella. She's nobody.'
The Wonderlanders lifted their heads and turned to one another.
How could this beautiful girl with her soft eyes and her black hair, styled like the princess's, not be Ali's heart? Their confusion vanished with the appearance of Bibwit Hare. If the royal tutor was after her, then the girl had to be Princess Alice. At the sight of Bibwit, Alice shouted, "Run!" But the scholarly albino was pretty fast and would have caught up with him in no time, if his robe hadn't sprouted the fluorescent feathers of a tuttle bird, ballooned around him, and lifted him into the air. "Alice, no!" Dodge glanced back. "What?"
"I didn't exactly mean to do it," said Alice.
This was not how she should have been using her imagination, and she knew it.
"I just didn't want him to catch us."
She'd had the faintest glimmer of an imagining to slow Bibwit down, and then, bam, it became a reality. Bibwit dropped from the sky into mud-choked grass, slipping and sliding as he tried to get out of it. But Alice and Dodge were already gone. They ran down brick lanes, cut through alleys and crossed thoroughfares. Eventually, the polished shop fronts and glistening streets of the capital city gave way to a wood. The trees and flowers chirped in surprise at the sight of the princess, making sure to look as in full bloom as possible, while moving their branches and petals out of her way as she and Dodge ran, jumping over rocks and creek beds, until they came to a cliff and could go no farther. Alice looked down from the vast height of the rock face. Below her stretched a body of water surrounded on all sides by a crystal barrier.
"What is it?"
she whispered, partly in awe and partly because she didn't want Bibwit to track her with his hearing.
"It's called the Pool of Tears,"
Dodge answered, also whispering.
"They say that if you fall in, it takes you out of Wonderland. But no one knows for sure. People have gone in, but nobody's ever come back."
Alice said nothing.
"People sometimes come here and wait for the return of those who've fallen in. They cry and let their tears drop into the water. That's how it got its name."
Alice stared down at the water.
It wasn't fair. How could the world be so sad on her birthday?
She tried to imagine what she'd do if Dodge or one of her parents fell into the pool of tears.
What would life be like without them?
But she couldn't do it. Imagination failed her.
"We should go back," Dodge said. "Yes, yes,"
said the trees and shrubs closest to them. People would come looking for them, Alice knew, maybe even Hatter himself. She could not escape being who and what she was.
"Maybe if we go back and act as though nothing has happened," she said, "it'll be like nothing did."
Dodge lent her his guardsman coat. No small gesture, considering what it meant to him, Alice knew. She wore it over her head like a shawl to avoid being recognized by Wonderlanders, part of a disguise that also included a caterpillar mask she imagined for herself. To prevent Bibwit from tracking them, she and Dodge didn't speak during the journey back to the palace, a journey that seemed much shorter than their escape had been. Sooner than soon, they were making their way along the row of glorious fountains that led up to the front gate. Alice could see the iridescent heart crystal beyond the locked entrance, giving off its white clouds of imaginative energy.
"Meow!"
A kitten with golden fur rubbed against her leg.
"Where did you come from?"
She took the kitten in her arms. It wore a ribbon for a collar, and attached to the ribbon was a card with a simple greeting. "Happy birthday, Alice."
"He knew me, even through my disguise."
"Who's it from?"
"It doesn't say."
Dodge looked around to see who might have been so generous. But of the many Wonderlanders enjoying the festivities outside the palace, no one paid them any attention.
"It's smiling," he said. "I didn't know cats could smile." "He's smiling because he's happy to be with me."
Alice wouldn't put her new pet down. The guards at the front gate recognized Dodge Anders, but said that they couldn't give entry to his friend without proper authority. Alice took off her mask.
"Our humble apologies, princess," said the guards,
promptly unbolting the gate. "We didn't expect to see you. Beg your pardon."
"I will pardon you on one condition," Alice announced. "You must tell no one that you saw me and Dodge outside the palace. Can I rely on you to say nothing?"
"Of course, Princess."
"Not a word."
The guards bowed. Alice and Dodge entered the palace. Once the gate was locked behind them, the kitten jumped from the princess's arms and bounded down the hall.
"Kitty, no!"
But the kitten ran and ran as if it knew exactly where it was going and had things to do, appointments to keep. Which, in fact, it did. Chapter 7 Queen Genevieve slipped away to her private rooms for a moment's rest, leaving the guests to occupy themselves. Without a word, Hatter Madigan followed and stood guard in the hall. The Queen's quarters consisted of three interconnected salons. One of these was filled with overstuffed couches and giant pillows to swaddle Her Highness in lazy comfort. Another was a dressing room, storehouse for the Queen's many royal outfits, and the third was a bathroom, outfitted with tasseled curtains, made of a fabric more voluptuous than any found outside the queendom. Genevieve studied her reflection in the bathroom looking-glass. Her daughter's birthday always made her feel old. It wasn't very long ago that she herself had begun her training to become queen. She saw lines at the corners of her eyes and on both sides of her mouth that hadn't been there a year earlier. It was a shame that imagination had its limits, that it could affect the physical realm only so far, and she couldn't imagine herself young again. What was that smell? A familiar, spicy, sweet aroma. She saw a plume of blue smoke and followed it into the sitting room, where she found the blue caterpillar coiled dreamily around his hookah and puffing away. Ordinarily, Genevieve would have been angry to discover anyone, let alone a giant larva, in her private sanctuary without having been invited. But the caterpillar was no ordinary giant larva. There were 8 caterpillars in Wonderland, each a different colour. They were the great oracles of the region, already old at the dawn of the queendom. They served the heart crystal, and didn't much care who occupied the throne, so long as the crystal remained safe. It was said that they could see the future because they refused to judge it. But lately, more and more members of the suit families were shrugging off the caterpillar's prophecies, claiming a reliance on them was nothing more than silly superstition, a remnant from more barbaric times. The caterpillars didn't actively interfere in the workings of the government or in the rivalries among the suit families, but they weren't above letting Genevieve glimpse the future if it concerned the safety of the heart crystal, so that she might take action to protect it. "Thank you for coming today, Caterpillar," she said. "It's an honour to play host to one so wise. We are all humbly grateful, especially Alice."
grumbled the Caterpillar, exhaling a cloud of smoke.
The smoke formed the shape of a butterfly with extended wings, then metamorphosed into a confusion of scenes. Genevieve saw a large cat grooming itself. She saw what looked like a lightning bolt. She saw Red's face. Then the smoke again formed the shape of a butterfly. The butterfly folded its wings, and Genevieve awoke on a couch with the smell of stale tobacco in her nostrils. The caterpillar was gone. Hatter Madigan and a walrus in a tuxedo jacket 2 sizes too small were standing over her.
"You must have fainted, madam," said the walrus butler. "I will get you some water, madam."
The walrus hurried out of the room. The queen remained silent for several moments. Then, "The blue caterpillar was here." Hatter Madigan frowned and put a hand to the brim of his top hat. His eyes scanned the room.
"I'm not quite sure what he showed me," Genevieve said.
"I will inform General Doppelganger and the rest of the millinery. We will prepare a defence for whatever's coming."
Just once, Queen Genevieve would have liked to relax the watchful vigilance she was forced to maintain every hour of every day to ensure Wonderland's safety.
The caterpillar's prophecies were always so vague. Sometimes their visions reflected only possibilities, the dark wishes of those who never planned to carry them out. But she couldn't take a chance, not when it concerned Red. "Make sure not to alarm our guests," she said.
"Of course." Hatter bowed and left the room.
Genevieve was lucky to have such a bodyguard. Hatter Madigan could swing a blade or several at once faster and more accurately than anyone alive. He was nimble, acrobatic. He could flip and tumble through the air without getting hit by a single cannonball spider in an onslaught of cannonball spiders. But even with all of his skills, he could not protect the Queen forever. How could he have known that the precautionary measures he was about to take would prove useless, that it was already too late?
Chapter 8.
The party had moved to the south dining room for tea, and most of the guests had returned home. The walrus made his way around the long table, at which sat Queen Genevieve and the suit families.
"Lump of sugar for your tea, madam? A drop of honey for your tea, sir?"
Genevieve smiled politely, not paying much attention to the goings-on. Because of the caterpillar's warning, because King Nolan should have returned hours ago, and yet she had received no word from him, she couldn't concentrate.
"Ah, but here were Alice and Dodge."
What misadventures they'd been getting up to only the spirit of Isa knew.
"Well, well, if it isn't the girl of the hour," she said. "And where have you two been?"
"Nowhere."
Doing her best to look innocent, Alice took her seat. She flashed Dodge a warning glance.
"Say nothing."
And he manned his guardsman's post as composedly as he could, across the room from his father. Jack of Diamonds, with tarty-tart crumbs on his cheeks down the front of his waistcoat and in his wig, glowered at them. He opened his mouth to announce Dodge's punishment just as Bibwit entered, caked in mud and spotted with feathers.
"Bibwit," gasped Queen Genevieve, "what happened to you?"
"Why, nothing, ever so much, I'd say. My robe took on certain, how shall I put it, birdish properties, and I found myself floating in the air. Happily, I soon fell into some mud, from which it took a bit of ingenuity to free myself."
Queen Genevieve blinked a moment.
"Alice?" "I didn't mean to," Alice said. "Things just started happening."
Jack of Diamonds leaped up on his chair and pointed a stubby finger at Dodge.
"He dared strike my royal person, and he kidnapped Princess Alice, and you can see by the dirt on their shoes that they left the palace. I demand that the commoner be deported to the crystal mines."
The suit families all started talking at once, grumbling their displeasure, guffawing in disbelief.
"Everyone, please, calm down," said Queen Genevieve.
"Bibwit, is this true?"
"Not precisely," answered Bibwit. "But I'm afraid the children did leave palace grounds momentarily."
"Dodge Anders," bellowed Sir Justice, "you get over here right this minute."
"Yes, sir."
"The crystal mines,"
Jack insisted, biting into a tarty-tart and spewing a mouthful of crumbs into the Lady of Spades' hair. The Lord of Diamonds stood up as if making an announcement in court.
"Good and kind Queen, I expect an increase in lands and tithes as a result of this unfortunate occurrence. My family's name has been tarnished beyond recognition by my son's treatment at the hands of this boy."
He gestured at Dodge. The Lady of Clubs whispered into her husband's ear,
"His family's name suffered more harm from his own boy than any other."
The Lord of Clubs snorted with laughter.
"Hear, hear," demanded the Lord of Spades, rising from his chair. "If the Diamonds receive more land and money, so do we."
Queen Genevieve was getting a headache.
"There will be no increase in lands or tithes for anybody."
The family has protested, their voices rising in heated debate. Alice's kitten trotted into the room.
"My cat!"
Alice cried. The room went quiet. "Your?" Queen Genevieve said. But that was all she got out, before a deep rumbling shook the palace. Goblets and chandeliers trembled, and the kitten began a gruesome transformation, its limbs stretching and expanding until it stood on two muscled legs, its forelegs having become two lean and powerful arms, and its front paws thick, with claws as sharp and long and wide as butcher's knives. Its face remained cat-like, with a flat pink nose, whiskers, and slobbery fangs. This was no adorable little kitten. This was the Cat, Red's top assassin, part human, part feline. Before General Doppelganger or Sir Justice Anders had time to act, before even Hatter Madigan could tumble into blade-spinning action, there came shouts and an explosion from outside the dining room. The heavy double doors blew apart, a wall crumbled, and a horde of Red's Guard soldiers charged through the blasted opening with swords raised. Standing amid the crumbled stone and splinters of wood was a nightmare version of Genevieve, a woman Alice had never seen before.
"Off with their heads!" the woman screamed. "Off with their stinking, boring heads!"
Chapter 9. Training the soldiers had taken time, effort. It disgusted Red how many fools claimed to be practitioners of black imagination, but didn't realize the amount of work needed to become halfway decent at it. Or they lacked the ambition, the spurs of vengeance and fuming hatred that helped black imagination flower within them. But these had never been the most disciplined members of the Queendom. Not only had Red been banished from Wonderland years ago, forced to live in a grubby fortress on Mount Isolation in the middle of the chessboard desert, acres of icy snow alternating with acres of tar and black rock, forming what looked from the air like a giant chessboard. Not only this, but she'd had to piece together a military force out of deserters, mercenaries, cutthroats. A good many of these had been twos and threes in the Wonderland deck. Guard soldiers who were little more than bodies to be thrown in front of incoming cannonball spiders and generator orbs, doomed to die. Luckily, Red also had fours, fives and sixes at her disposal, and a ragtag group of ex-Wonderlanders who'd never been part of the deck at all, but who hadn't felt at home living in bright, happy Wonderland. But how many times in the past fistful of years had she toured her training camps in the hope of witnessing the glory of a budding war machine with ranks of well-trained soldiers eager for bloodshed? 347. And how many times had she been disappointed, seeing only misfits engaged in sloppy, inefficient military manoeuvres? 346. She once came upon a six-card, a lieutenant, yelling at some idiot two who was cradling a cute, fuzzy guinea pig. "I tell you to think black thoughts and you come up with that," the lieutenant had screamed. "Is a guinea pig bad? Do you consider a guinea pig the representation of all that's evil?" "Maybe, if it's an evil guinea pig." The lieutenant and two-card had eyed the animal, which sat in the soldier's folded arm, twitching its nose, oblivious. "That is not an evil guinea pig," the lieutenant had shouted. Even though she needed every able body she could get, Red ordered the lieutenant to kill the soldier. By the force of her vindictive will, as much as by the training the soldiers endured for 10 hours of every lunar cycle, her army was at last ready. She decided upon Alice's 7th birthday as the occasion of attack. Wonderland would be celebrating its future queen. What better time to wrench back what was hers? She would give Wonderland its future queen, all right, but it wouldn't be the one citizens were expecting. She sent out seekers, deadly creatures with vulture bodies and fly heads, for aerial reconnaissance. She had bred and trained them herself. Her troops suited up, sharpened blades, loaded crystal shooters and orbs. Red stood before them on the jagged promontory of Mount Isolation. She spread out her arms as if to embrace all that was bad, and threw her voice into the wind.
"Years ago, I was told to leave the comforts of home by my own family. I was removed from the power to which I'd been born. All of you have had to leave your homes for one reason or another, and together we have suffered through our lives in this barren land. But all that's over now. Today we will return to our birthplace and remake it in our image, which is to say, my image. Today we will make history. But," and here she scowled down at her troops, massed before her at the foot of the mountain, "if there be any doubters among you, any who are unsure of their willingness to die for my cause, let them step forward now. They will be excused from this day's battle until they are ready to fight, and they can enjoy a nice cup of tea." Red then did an extraordinary thing. She smiled, but her facial muscles weren't accustomed to being used in this way, and the soldiers thought they had never seen her look more fierce. They knew better than to step forward. "To victory, then!" Red shouted.
She had to give her rogue soldiers credit. They might not have been the most imaginative. They might have been novices in black imagination. But every single one of them had learned well how to kill. Equally good with swords, knives, spiked clubs, spears, orbs, crystal shooters, they had little trouble getting past the guards that patrolled the edges of the chessboard desert, meant to contain her and her kind. And Red herself made sure that no warning dispatch made it to the palace, rerouting it to oblivion by the power of her imagination. They had little trouble butchering the interior guards. They marched into Wondertropolis, hardly the worse for wear, trailing blood-red clouds and howling winds. At the sight of them, Wonderlanders, who had been celebrating only moments before, abandoned their games and ran off to what security their homes afforded. Every Wonderlander over the age of 12 remembered the devastation of the civil war between Red and Genevieve. They knew why Red had come. The palace appeared in view, the heart crystal the only bright light in the gloom Red had brought with her. She ordered her troops to surround the place. In her imagination's eye, she saw her most formidable henchman, in the form of a kitten, padding silently along heart-shaped halls, past watchposts where guardsmen said,
"Hey, look at the cute cat," and "Here, kitty, kitty."
But the kitty was on a mission and didn't stop. He approached the security oversight room and transformed himself from feline to assassin. The cat smashed through the locked door, surprising the five guards lounging by the controls and monitoring crystals. With a few swings of his powerful arms, he flung them down like so many rag dolls, leaving them slumped and bleeding on the floor. He ripped the master key from the waistband of the highest-ranking guard and inserted it into the security console. He turned the key and flipped release switch after release switch. All over Heart Palace, bolts unlocked, doors and gates swung open, and Red's troops stormed in. The cat turned back into a kitten and bounded toward the south dining room, where the Hearts and their guests still had no idea what was happening. Red entered the palace for the first time since she was a girl. The palace in which she'd been born and spent most of her young life, her palace, and all the hurt and resentment she'd tried to keep in check for so many years started to boil over. With every step she took toward her sister, she grew angrier and angrier. So what if she'd been a bad girl? So what if she'd experimented with artificial crystal and imagination stimulants? So what if she'd never cared for justice, love, duty to the people, blah, blah, blah? She was her own person. Why couldn't her parents have respected that and left her alone instead of trying to turn her into the princess she could never be? Why couldn't they have loved her for who she was? The time she was removed from succession to the throne came back to Red with the full force of its heart-stopping gall. The ever-wise Queen Theodora announced that she could not allow such an unruly daughter to have queenly power. Genevieve was to be queen instead of her. Red's features immediately began to change, to twist and sharpen, so potent was the fury within her. She had always been prone to jealousy, rage, and bitter hatred, but now she had fuel for all three to last a lifetime, and she cultivated them until... Abandoning herself to her wrath, she slipped into her mother's dressing room. "Even you cannot take away what is mine by birthright," she snarled and placed a deadly pink mushroom on her mother's tongue. Fed by the queen's saliva, the roots of the fungus worked their way down the sleeping sovereign's throat and strangled her heart. The mushroom cap poked out of her mouth to signify that the heart had stopped beating. As for her father, she let him live. Weak, useless man that he'd always been. After the murder of his beloved Theodora, Timon went insane, chatting to his dead wife and shuffling aimlessly through the palace. And Red would have been queen. She would have ruled with all the innate power she possessed, if not for the presumption of her sister. It was almost laughable. Goody Two-Shoes Genevieve actually believed that she should be queen. Red armed her followers, and Genevieve organized hers. They clashed. People died, and homes were destroyed. Red knew her imagination to be stronger than Genevieve's, but her forces were outnumbered, and she didn't have anyone from the millinery on her side, no one to rival Hatter Madigan. But now she had the cat, and the Seekers. Still, the sting of being roundly defeated and banished from Wonderland by her younger sister had been an embarrassment impossible to live down. Seething with anger, Red strode toward the south dining room, paying no attention to the explosions going off to the left and right of her. The palace guardsman falling dead at the hands of her soldiers. An orb generator detonated directly in front of her, but without slowing her pace, she walked through the smoke and flames. She stood in the ruins, face to face with her sister at last, and screamed her head off. She would kill them all.